it seems to me, overall, I hear a kind of theme that I heard in Hunter, and that is a kind of what may sound like a kind of modest affirmation of the ability of our faith communities, our churches, to change the world, both an affirmation that we're under obligation to be a prophetic witness in word and deed, but also I was just struck that all three speakers kept that sort of maybe more than political action and in different ways focused upon the congregation as the saints. So that just interested me. I do agree with Chris that the Hunter book, I thought, kind of wimped out toward the end and saying, you know, we should be a witness, but of course he's a sociologist. He's not a theologian or biblical interpreter, but Chris has just reminded me that when Christians witness, our witness has a kind of abrasive quality to it, and that what we have to say in the name of Jesus Christ can often be very discordant and dissonant with the official voices in the world. But.
Okay. Please.
Thank you. My name is Howard Castleberry. I'm a priest at Christ Episcopal Church. Yes, I'm an Episcopalian, brave enough to come to a Baptist conference.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. You've been most welcoming. I want to build on what Pastor Say said, and then I have a question. I find it interesting that Friday I was in Houston at a conference held by Oxford University, Wycliffe Hall, their seminary, and the title was Reforming Society, Reforming the Church. And there's a number of books out there, just in the last year or two, Francis Chan, David Platt, there are numerous books out there that are really, in a more blunt way, saying what Pastor Say said, which is that the world sees the hypocrisy of our church. One of the speakers in the seminar in Houston, Michael Horton, he's written a book called Christless Christianity. Have you heard of it? Well, Barna did a study for him of evangelical Christians professing regular attendance to church. As it turns out, through the questions that were asked, only 3% of them could really be called Christian. Now, I find that alarming, and I don't know how true it is, but the point is, not being able to truly and cleanly articulate your faith and living it out was part of the determinant. So here's my question. Is part of reforming the world reforming the church? If we're going to build disciples, if we're going to do Matthew 28, make disciples of nations, how are we to do that if we don't have disciples in our church?
Okay, we probably don't need responses from all four, but at least two of you respond. Who wants to start? Chris, you've been given the mantle.
I would just say that reforming the church is a great challenge. I was speaking with someone earlier today, our church ecclesia that we started. By nature, I'm a church planner, pastor, but we spent 2 years with a very traditional church who had tremendous facilities and great hope, but reform was a really hard thing to do, and Jesus talked about these wineskins. I always thought it was a metaphor, but apparently not, and I think it can be very hard, so I don't know what that looks like. I do believe, though, that there is a conversion or a resurrection that might be a lot more fun than reform. I tend to lean towards those resurrection metaphors. So I think it's time for the church to be resurrected, and I think our great mission will allow for that.
Okay. Question.
Mike Broadway, I teach ministers at Shaw Divinity School in Raleigh, North Carolina, but I commute there from here now. So,
good.
A couple of thoughts that I had pertaining to the metrics of how we know when we're being faithful. Certainly, if we go back to the original text of Ahaz, I mean, there was a metric that Isaiah had already given him. He said, "The spoil of the poor is in your houses, and why are you crushing the face of the poor?" I mean, to see those things go away would have been a good measure of how Ahaz and his people could have shown themselves to be faithful. But it seems there's a little space in what's been said today that leaves open a question for me, whether when Millard Fuller said he was going to build one house at a time, was he being more Christian than when he said no more shacks? That there is a kind of systemic change that churches can be about. You know, when the grace period ministry out of a church shuts down the local payday lending businesses that are predatory by offering a more fair payday lending system, is that excluding the need to also close the loophole in Texas law, which allows shops to open up businesses and charge 700% interest? I mean, all of that seems like it's in the range of what faithful world changing might look like. So,
I would think so, and I think Christians ought to take every opportunity we get in a democracy to work for justice, greater equality, and I like the way you focus on specific economic injustice, and economic injustice is a big deal for Christians because of Jesus. And I like where we referred to, you know, this young lawyer comes up to Jesus and asks, the young man comes up and asks, "What do I have to do to inherit eternal life?" And it's just wonderful how Jesus refuses to talk about this big high-flown theological concept. He says, here's a little suggestion, obey all the Ten Commandments. And then when the guy says, "Oh, I do all that," he says, "Well, one more suggestion, go sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and then follow me." To believe that the person who said that was the Son of God, that gives us a little edge on stuff. I must say, we mentioned the healthcare debate. I was listening, and I was all for healthcare reform and did anything I could in my own way to support that and speak for it and all. However, I was shaken when I saw a group of economists, godless secular economists, I presume, talking about the economics of healthcare, and they were kind of basically saying, how in the world are we going to afford healthcare? We got to make some hard decisions and this kind of thing. I had one suggestion, get out of Afghanistan and you could get healthcare. But one of the economists said, it is not an irrelevant note that most of the money spent on your health care will be spent in the last year of your life. And that's not health care. That's called immortality fantasy. And most of the health care in our country goes toward people who are terminal, you know. And then this economist looked into the TV and said, who's going to teach Americans that they are mortal? They are going to die. And he said, I worry that a lot that passes for health care and health care reform is continuing fantasy cultivation. And I thought, boy, I'm a preacher. I should get up every Sunday and say, hey, all of you, I don't care what your cholesterol is. You're dying. You're Ash Wednesday. You came from dirt and you're going back to dirt. And that is not an injustice. But I was just thinking, when you get into certain political problems, you also get into certain questions of character. And what do we hope for? And who are we? And what are our images of ourselves, etc.? And we follow a Savior who said, life's abundance does not consist in possessions. And yet we allow so many of our people to proceed right down that path in thinking, if I can just accumulate all this stuff together, that is roughly equivalent to salvation. And, well, so, my little speech.
Any one of you want to follow that up? It's pretty good, wasn't it?
By the way, from what Chris described of his church, I would call his church not Ecclesia, but Operation Rescue. I guarantee you there are people at Chris's church that look a lot like me, educated, affluent, and all. And Chris's church sounds like it's giving those people an opportunity in some little way, his Advent program, to break free of some of their servitudes. And that doesn't mean that it's total yet. His work's still in process. I haven't heard his last sermon. But John Wesley had more rich people in his societies than were in the general London population, even though Wesley said nasty, terrible things about the rich and wonderful things about the poor. And one of the things Wesley did was provide rich people some help. And I got three congregations I can name you right now in Alabama that are growing and bringing in new disciples and all because they are biracial, and basically they are saying to the people of Alabama, we know you're tortured about the racial situation in America. We know you're frustrated that things can't be done about it. Well, come join us in this little church, in this place. We're doing something about it. And all three of them are growing. People are driving miles just to get to be part of something that causes, that doing something good about something causes them anguish.
Tyler, Texas.
Yep, Tyler, Texas, Dick Hurst.
A medical doctor, by the way, so he may refute some of your...
You got into the theology of bombing. And it's a very real theology, obviously. But, of course, basically hellish theology. But I'm wondering if there's not something on the other hand. Because after we've expended all this effort in a lot of places like Vietnam, suddenly there's a Baptist association. And it's very, very interesting. I went to Iran, saw the effects after the bombing there of working with refugees. Needless to say, in northern Iraq and Kosovo, and a breath of a touch in Chechnya. So can we fine-tune the effects of war, that it be more Christian in its end result? Maybe I'm not putting that just right, but I think you may get the gist. Thank you.
So fine-tune?
Fine-tune the effects of our military expenditure in different parts of the world. Right. Well, for instance, look at Japan. World War II opened it up to Christianity like it had never been opened up before.
Okay.
Thank you.
George, you can...
Well, may I just say, I think it's one of the reasons none of us are running for office. I'm thrilled that I get to stand behind, I don't even have a pulpit, but I say I do, a stool, really. But we are just crazy enough, I think, as Will reminded us, to believe that Jesus was up to something, and that fighting evil with evil was not the mandate we're given. Now, like the lady in Haiti, we get to go, how does that play out over the long haul? I don't know, but I believe the words of our Savior, and they are idealistic and crazy, and calling people to nonviolence and when they are experiencing injustice and suffering pain, and pain is challenging, but we just get to keep preaching what we're called to preach and hope somewhere along the way someone listens.
I'm thinking that we were already trying to fine-tune war. We have drones and smart bombs and those sorts of things. And I think that what's happened is with fine-tuning it, we have distanced ourselves from what we are really involved in. And if we were to really fine-tune it, I think maybe the new rules of engagement would be that you can only have war in hand-to-hand combat. And therefore, we would all personally have to know what it feels like to be in harm's way, that there would be no bombing from afar. Now we all have to get personally engaged in this and put our own lives on the line. I think that'd be a more interesting fine-tuning of war. I suspect we wouldn't go as much, although they did one time. But the technology problem of fine-tuning war distances us from the real experience of what that means, and I think that's a problem for us.
Today we call it football.
I would bring this back, if we could for a minute, from the war of our nations to the war of our churches. Our son, who grew up as a son of a social work dean and a seminary Baptist dean, became a Mennonite and has for 5 years pastored a Spanish-speaking congregation down on the border. And when he made that decision, he said, "Mama, what would have happened to us if Baptists had to agree like I had to agree when I agreed to take this church to work for peace?" And we have laughed in our family about that, but it's not funny. When we talk about not only Dick taking on what our nation has done and its repercussions, how do we respond to what our churches have done and their consequences in the lives of persons?
Okay. Please.
Oh, sorry.
Identify yourself, please.
Oh, my name's Tia, and I was a student here. And in my naive observation, it seems like there's less disagreement about what the consequences of our Christianity should be, that we should practice charity, that we should do good and things like that. But there seems to be more disagreement about what the contents of the gospel is. And because of that, there's consequences, and I think one of them could be that we don't do what God or Jesus commands us to do. And so I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more, and there were some allusions to it, about that if our gospel was maybe correctly communicated, then our change in this world, individually and corporately, may happen. Because it seems like inside and outside of the church, as well as between the pulpit and the congregation, through some of your examples, there's more disagreement about what the contents of the gospel is than what our mandate is and how that should be carried out. And if there's a correlation, and if you could speak to that, please.
One of my pastors, I think is relevant, pointed out to me that in Matthew 28, Jesus doesn't say, he says, go and make disciples of all nations. How do you do that? By baptizing and teaching them all I have commanded you. And I was thinking when you were talking, would it be fascinating to, to go by a church and they had a big sign out front saying, come here and we will teach you everything Jesus commanded. We won't hold anything back, despite your income. We'll tell you everything Jesus will teach. We'll teach you the whole thing. And I do wonder that I just think a lot of damage has been done our witness in very quickly saying, now what can we do to help make this war a little more just than the last war? Or what can we do to be responsible citizens and to be helpful, and what, how can we go in? Rather than say we just ought to teach, and that's pretty good work, you know, creating a Mennonite for a son. That's impressive. And I was at a group of Mennonite pastors talking about preaching one time, and we were talking about the Beatitudes. And I showed them a sermon that I was kind of proud of on the Beatitudes, and talking about this is Jesus' vision for the future, and this is not a prescription for politics, but this is a vision for the new world we should be living into. And this sweet little Mennonite pastor stood up afterwards and said, while you were interpreting Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, did it ever occur to you, like, just to, like, do it? And that was a very embarrassing question to ask of a Methodist. But I wonder if maybe my job as a preacher, I don't know what to do about the government, the army. You know, I'm a preacher. And so I'm free, like the brother here, stand up and criticize everybody. And I was criticized for criticizing George Bush. And I said, no. Remember my stuff on Bill Clinton? It was worse than this. You know, I'm against all of them. And I do wonder sometimes if we would focus upon that radical quality of the gospel. I got a letter a while back complaining about one of my preachers who, during the prayer for others on Sunday morning, prayed for Osama bin Laden. And this layperson said, we just don't pay a preacher to do this. So I called up the little preacher. And I said, you know, the laity find this kind of stuff hard to take. And, you know, it's okay with me, but the laity. And the preachers listened to this, and he said, Bishop, just for your information, I happen to believe that the guy who said, pray for your enemies, bless those who persecute you, I actually think he was the Son of God. Well, I just wonder if our greatest activism and prophetic witnesses begins in worship of a true and living God, and then we work from there.
Very good. Please. Now, the young men from Wilshire said they were going to ask a question. Now, one of you's got to ask a question, so get ready, okay? Over here, go ahead, please.
Yes, my name is Chad Chaddock, a pastor in San Antonio. The idea of changing the world is an exciting idea, and I think when my church, I share that with my congregation, people get excited about the possibility of changing the world. In fact, they're more excited about changing the world than they are perhaps about changing their neighbor or actually loving the person right next door. And so I wonder if perhaps you would comment. Is it possible that changing the world is somewhat akin to humility, that it's something that we achieve when we don't really shoot at it, if that makes sense?
So we change the world when we really don't aim to do that. Is that sort of the idea?
Since we mentioned Mennonites, I think it's fascinating that, you know, we have no Methodist congregations in Iraq because we decided to limit our evangelistic work to wherever the U.S. government said we could work. And but the Mennonites have congregations in Iraq. They're like about the same size as Mennonite congregations in San Antonio, you know. It's not a popular thing. But the way they do mission work is they send out a group of Mennonites to just go set up shop and live in these places. And they work from there. And what they hope is some of them will say, gosh, you people seem so different. How'd you get that way? So the word humility comes to mind. And when Chris was criticizing our kind of dominance. You know, we're going to win the world. We're going to make disciples. We're going to, you know, that I do think that kind of quiet, humble witness. And I remember I first heard of Mennonites when after an anti-war demonstration when I was a student in Washington. We all went down, had a wonderful time, and we did more than protest the war. I woke up in my sleeping bag on the mall on Sunday morning, and there was this sweet little woman out there picking up trash. And she had this little white bonnet on her and this out-of-date skirt. And she was over there, and there was other people picking up our trash after the anti-war demonstration. And I asked her, I said, do you work for the government? And she says, no, I don't approve of the government. And I said, well, who are you? And she said, I'm a Mennonite. And I said, what's a Mennonite? And she said, well, we're the people that pick up the trash after you've made your heroic statement against the war. Okay.
Yeah, I don't really know how I could add much to that other than to say I think part of what you're hinting at is that it comes with the humility that doesn't state grand plans. And I think most of us are tired of it anyway. This is what denominations and institutions have to do is state grand plans, right? We've been through one recently in Texas, and it's a noble gesture to say, let's put the gospel and scriptures in the hand of every person in Texas. But those goals often don't take us those places. They're the kind of things made for press releases, and I think people are frankly tired of that. Where this simple little movement we started, Advent Conspiracy, was just, we have four precepts: worship fully, spend less, give more, love all. And we just believe we were subversive. And so now we have literally tens of thousands of churches, small groups, youth groups that have done this with us, but it was never a plan. It was never a press release. It was never a, that's what we're gonna do. But because it was right and just, people felt in their gut, like that's the right thing to do, it spreads. And so I think we ought to believe that we can change the world. I just think we ought not to, well, much like Bishop Blumen heard in his grand sermon, right? Could you quit talking about that and let's go do it? You know, I think we got a lot of people that go, that sounds great, but we've heard it before. And so I think the more we lean on action, action is humble.
Hey, one more question. Kyle Childress, ask a question.
Oh.
Come on.
Ask a question.
Sure. This is Kyle Childress from Nacogdoches.
Yeah.
Bright's.
I've heard his questions before.
Well, I've resonated with Mike Broadway over there. I mean, working as a Baptist in East Texas, everybody in East Texas is going to get up and say, you're right. It's about me and Jesus and our personal responsibility. And I agree with that. We all agree with that. But sometimes the challenge of being a pastor is helping a congregation look beyond their personal, individualistic would be a better word, the individualistic. And so part of my, you know, and some of this I deal with reading Hunter, and with what we've said today, because I see us coming back to talk about it is about Jesus, it's about the people in the pew taking Jesus seriously. But as Mike reminded us, there are things that sometimes the church does have to say in Austin. Now, I want to say it as Jesus, talk about Jesus. And that's part of the tension that we're trying to find in our churches. Hunter really is critical of us thinking that everything happens in Austin and Washington, and I think he's right. But I also have people in the pew who think it's only about handing somebody a tract. And Will, when you use the word witness in East Texas, the first thing my folks are going to say is, well, you're talking about handing people a tract. So the translation of witness and how we do all that, I just feel the tensions of it. So I don't know. You put me on the spot,
Don.
That's
all right.
I don't have a question. I'm just rambling.
Well, I will ask the final question. Thank you, Kyle, for rambling. It inspired. Oh, there's one here. Great.
Yeah, go. Hi, my name is Brian Horning. I'm a director of Family Life Ministry here in Waco in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And my question is obviously directed towards family life and the crisis in America especially, but all around the world, Europe. The family life crisis in that our call to change the world as the church is now focusing more than ever, needs to be focused on Christ in the home. And I'm kind of surprised I haven't heard much about that today. I'm just wondering what each of you or a couple of you would have to say about that crisis in the church and our call on the church for that.
Well, I think I would say the hardest neighbor God has given me to love is the man who sleeps next to me and has for 40 years. And on the other turn, the hardest neighbor he has had to love is me. And whatever our family relationships may be, that we are called to discipleship. And I find the hardest place to forgive 70 times 7, to love selflessly, to handle anger in ways that edify and build up rather than tear down. And if I can learn to live that there, I can live that with the neighbor that passes me on the road. At the same time, I was working on a chapter early this morning for the family ministry book I'm working on families and service. And I tell the story of a 14-year-old daughter in our home who decided at the time we were both seminary professors that church was not where she wanted to go on a Sunday morning. Church attendance was not optional in our home, so I would drag her out, not literally, but metaphorically, and make her go to church. But I was pretty sure that I was not contributing to a deepened spirituality in my daughter by making her go and suffer through church. And so being the social worker I am and having a social activist daughter that I did, I called one of my students, or alumni by then, who was director of the shelter for homeless families in Louisville, Kentucky, where we lived, and said, could we volunteer as a family? And she said, well, we don't have family volunteers. And I said, this is Diana, and now you do. And so we went through the training, and we spent a year they called us a mentoring family. I called us friends, to a family that had some younger children, and my kids helped them with, they were behind in school because they had moved so often and lived so tenuously. And we spent a year driving back and forth as they moved into a little cinder block house on the opposite side of the county from us, talking about what it meant to be us and what it meant to be them and what it meant to be people of faith. I don't know that we did much of all in anything in their lives, but I learned a lot about my daughter, and I learned about what it means to be Christian, and it sent me on a journey of research that has taken me this last however long that's been, in which we found that when we get involved in caring for neighbor as families, it helps us with our stuff as Christians. And we also found in that if you want to grow sticky faith in young people, children and adolescents, you get them involved in service alongside adults in their community. And by sticky faith, I mean faith that helps them stick in with the church as they become young adults who can make the decision that they're not going to be involved. It's more significant than camp, than worship, than youth group, than all the other things we throw at kids, because it says you matter right now, not what you're going to be when you grow up. You matter right now. You have a faith to live. You have neighbors to love. So I don't know if that helps any, but thanks for telling me, having the opportunity to say
I've like
got a new
that,
book coming out.
That closing emphasis that I think, I'd say this, that I think we got to come to terms with the fact Jesus is very negative about the family and marriage, and so was Paul, and that Jesus rescued people from their families by making them disciples. They could only be a disciple if they abandoned their marriage and family. I think that's just a weird kind of thing. We gotta, and the church believes in family, and our definition of family is called church. Your biological family, you know, is not adequate to saving anybody. And I like this emphasis there that I know a lot of marriages and families in my church that are in big trouble because they've acted like being in a family is enough for discipleship, or being married to somebody else is a worthy vocation. The church believes that to have a good family or to have a good marriage, you've got to have bigger interests than the family or the marriage. And we have this thing called baptism, which puts you in a family that is so much bigger and of more greater significance than the family you were born into. And again, I think this is relevant. We change the world by giving people something to do with their marriage that's more important than their marriage, by giving people a family bigger than the one they were born into. And, the American family is in big trouble. And not only in Sarah Palin's family. I mean, it's all over. And the answer to that, I think, is the Christian faith, the church. And I agree with you that I know a lot of people who've been attracted to the church, not first of all because of Jesus, but because they knew they needed help to stay married, and they knew they needed help to be in a family, and they've come to the right place with the church.
Hey, Don, I can say this in 20 seconds, but I just to add clarity, I agree with both of what has been said, that I think the more challenging thing for us in the church is for Jesus to truly be Lord, which means we have to call out idols. And family is a big idol. It's also a place, right? If you know a kid whose mom doted on him so much, she loved him, he was the world, right? That kid's messed up. Like, as a grown-up, he's a mess, right? And has very few friends, because it's not good for that kid or for his mom, you know? And so, as a pastor, if somebody has an idol of sex, we call it out really quickly. But if their kid is their idol, it's a little bit harder to call out, but still not helpful. And so the journey of Christianity means we begin to give it away. It means that you do say, I'm going to serve my kid in the inner city. Well, that's dangerous. Yeah, well, that's the call of Jesus. It's dangerous. It's beautiful. It's adventurous. And so when we do those things, I think we lay down those idols quite naturally.
Word.
I have to say one more thing, which is, we'll take on the family another time, Will. I think that's a worthy conversation about what is the teaching about family. But secondly, I said all that. What I should have said when I finished is, we don't serve in order to help our children have faith. We serve because it's what we're called to do and to be.